Drive Time on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Zurich. Here in Ireland for over 40 years, that's four decades of trust, reliability and expertise. Visit Zurich.ie.
Now, Friday saw the publication of a new joint framework between the Irish and British governments for addressing the legacy issues of the Troubles. US Congressman Richard Neal has been one of the most prominent American voices in Ireland and the Good Friday Agreement for many years. He's also been a congressman in the US for over three decades. So how do we maintain good relations between the US and Ireland at a time when relations between Europe and the US are at a low ebb? Richard Neal joins us now on the line, and you're very welcome to the programme this afternoon, Congressman. Thank you for joining us.
Pleased to be with you. Thank you.
So we might have a chat about this new framework agreement. We did discuss it last week when it was announced. But from your perspective and from the perspective of the United States, how significant is it, do you think?
I think it's very significant. I think there's a great irony to the issue that after all these years, decades, and some would say centuries of a disagreement about the status of the island and particularly the six counties in the north, that one of the things that's striking about this issue is that all the political parties on the island of Ireland agreed that what had been proposed heretofore was inadequate. So I think as we go forward, certainly confidence building is going to be important and credibility will be everything. But these families have a right to understand and to know for closure purposes in their own lives what really happened. I knew those families from Bloody Sunday. I spoke with many of them the day after David Cameron apologized on the floor of Commons. They never sought remuneration. They were looking for some sense of disclosure as to what had really happened on that day. Those are examples, and I think there are a series of high-profile cases that should be addressed. I've urged prime ministers all the way back to Tony Blair to take this up with some enthusiasm for those families who did not know what happened to those who perhaps might have disappeared.
But it's interesting, as you say, that you need to go forward building trust, particularly with the families. For example, Michael McKinney, whose brother William was killed on Bloody Sunday in Derry in 1972, he said that the UK government is simply not trusted by victims. Do you trust the UK government on this? And do you think the families really can trust them?
Ironically, I'm going to be talking to the secretary later on, and I'm going to be talking to Simon Harris on Thursday. I think that we're going to have to wait and see what the finality of this is. And again, for credibility purposes, it's very important. But I also think that for many of us, myself included, we took up a lot of these very controversial cases. Places like Birmingham, for example, that come to mind. The Joe Doherty case. We go way back to Bloody Sunday and these other high-profile cases, and including we want to know what happened to Raymond McCord's son. I think that the American dimension was very important in terms of promoting credibility, but overwhelmingly, we were the ones that pursued these cases, and we were proved to be right in the end. So I understand the suspicion that some might have, but let's give this the best effort we can.
And is there anything specifically in this new framework that was announced that might make you optimistic, or that you would say to families, you know, maybe you don't need to be as skeptical this time round?
Well, I think that one of the most important, again, dimensions here is that the Irish government has embraced this package, and their embrace, as you know, was not even tentative the last time around. They were highly critical of it, as were many of the political parties in the North, unionist and nationalist. They're both traditions. So I think here, let's see how it unfolds, how it plays out. But I think we're going to continue to monitor it here with the same, I think, sense of responsibility that we did with all of the other cases over all of these years that we have kept an eye on
and been vindicated. Can I ask you what you'll be saying to the secretary later?
Well, yes, I'm going to say to him that credibility is everything, that there can be no foot dragging here, and that the last framework that was presented really fell down on all those measures. And this time around, these families, they want to know, but in the end, they want to be believed. And I think that's essential. If you have a family member who hasn't known what happened to a loved one 35 years ago, and there's a chance here to really find out what happened, that's essential.
And you mentioned the Irish government, a very positive reaction from the Irish government this time round. You may have noticed that some unionist reaction was actually pretty scathing about the Irish government being so closely involved in this framework. They're calling it dual control over a Northern Irish process. I wonder, what do you make of that criticism and how do you appease those concerns?
Well, that's a familiar refrain, but I would advise those as well that they should look back to Strand 2 of the Good Friday Agreement, which gives Dublin a consulting role in day-to-day affairs of the North. That was what the parties all agreed to in this instance. So I think that everybody had to give up something to get to the Good Friday Agreement. It is an extraordinary achievement, but Strand 2, Belfast, Dublin was everything.
I might move on to some broader issues, Congressman, if that's okay with you, and the broader issue of
sure.
Irish-American relations specifically. And of course, that's going to be underpinned and reiterated when a new Irish embassy is going to be opened soon in the US. But there's also quite a lot of pressure and tension in the relationship that I think hasn't existed before. Would you agree with that?
I think there have been. Yes, I think that that's understandable at the moment. I think that sovereign people make decisions based upon their own experience and their own processes going forward. So I understand that. I think that those, for the most part, those have been expressed professionally. And I think that the relationship between Ireland and the United States continues to remain very strong. I've just been hosting during the last week a large contingent from Killarney and from the Dingle Peninsula that are here at the Eastern States Exposition, and hosted a dinner for them. And I thought that the conversations went very well.
Is anyone saying to you that they're reluctant to go to the States now?
I hope not. I think that the president has made comments that I understand can be very offensive, as they have been, as they relate to Canada, which is a longtime friend and ally of ours. But also comments that I think that in some instances have been unfounded as they relate to Europe and NATO. I was the lead negotiator on USMCA. It was supposed to be reviewed next year. So I think this position of pushing away our friends and allies is mistaken.
Yeah, and I suppose specifically we're seeing this week a cleave between the US and its allies, specifically on the issue of Gaza, and it's one of the issues as well where Ireland and the US will differ very dramatically, isn't it? I wonder, can you understand why a lot of Irish people can't understand the American approach to what's happening in Gaza?
I can't speak for how the Irish people feel about America's approach, but I can understand the Irish position from Irish history and colonialism. I understand that entirely. My grandparents were immigrants, and I know that experience that they shared widely across the diaspora. But at the same time, I also think that in the end, we have to have a two-state solution. And I think that certainly the creation of a Palestinian state, land for peace, has always been part of international agreements, and I'm hopeful that that will occur here as well, and simultaneously guaranteeing Israel's security.
Yeah. And yet, so what then do you think of what the US is doing this week? You know, denying a visa even to the president of the Palestinian Authority, Mahmoud Abbas, to attend that UN General Assembly meeting, boycotting Israel and the US, boycotting the meeting entirely.
Well, I think that is short-sighted. I think that we are, I think, ground zero in free speech. Our institutions are built upon the notion that our First Amendment guarantees a second opinion, but most importantly, a freedom of expression. So I don't think in this instance here that that's a wise consideration. I think that in the end, they are going to be part of the discussions for the Palestinian people. And I hope that that would be reconsidered. But I think that it's ill considered to deny that visa.
And then on the sort of the broader picture of how the US is seen in the world in terms of its support for what Israel has been doing, the UN report last week saying that there is a genocide happening in Gaza, the IPC report saying a couple of weeks ago that there's famine happening in Gaza. And every expert we speak to on this show, Congressman, says the US could stop this today if they wanted to.
Well, if you recall, mistakenly, the president said that he was going to stop it on day one of becoming president.
Yeah.
That certainly didn't happen. And I think that even at this time, I think the situation is so tenuous. I am a sponsor of a ceasefire request in Congress. I do think that a negotiated settlement in the end, as I'll reiterate, guaranteeing Israel's security and a role for self-governance and the creation of a Palestinian state. Look, there's a lot of nuance that go into this, and a lot of these issues I thought would have been part of the final determination, as was the case with the Good Friday Agreement. But instead, I think that we have taken a position here in some instances, as it relates even to NATO and our friends across the globe, that is short-sighted.
And is it short-sighted, or do you think this is the new U.S. way in the world? You know, do you think this will end with Donald Trump's time in the White House, or is this a new view that the U.S. has of the world, an isolationist view?
I don't think it's a new view, because overwhelmingly the American people support NATO and they oppose Russian aggression and expansionism. And I would give the historic highlight that for 80 years, every American president until now has been supportive of the concept of NATO and opposition to any Russian aggression or expansion. The events over the last 2 weeks, whether it was in the Polish airspace or Estonian airspace, I think that serves the wrong message to the rest of the world. And that is that America, for all of those years, pretty much guaranteed Europe's security. But it was a partnership. I'm supportive of the idea that NATO countries should pay more, but I was supportive of that long before I knew who Donald Trump was. Mm. We called it burden sharing in previous sessions of the Congress. And I think now that that NATO has proved their determination, the American people are not being asked to send soldiers. We're being asked for monetary support. America can well afford that to make sure that we push back on Soviet aggression.
Yeah, I understand that you can afford to do that. I suppose I'm more interested in whether or not America wants to do that, you know, because as you say, presidents up to this point have been very supportive of NATO, but the American people knew where Donald Trump stood on NATO before they elected him a second time. And they elected him, you know, pretty comprehensively. And they knew where he stood on a number of these issues, didn't they? And they elected him. Yeah, so the conclusion that you're tempted to draw from that then is that they got what they asked for and they knew what they were getting.
Well, I think that the president's deference to Putin is mistaken. And again, when you consider that Russia has an economy that is smaller than California's, there's no real relationship that we have with the Russians as it relates to economics, for example. But I do think the guarantee that NATO offered back to President Truman and reinforced by every president since, Republican and Democrat, should be the one that we've honored. It worked. I was in Berlin at the time that the wall came down. I was there just maybe a couple of days after the wall came down. I visited Warsaw. I saw what had happened, the liberation, the sense of freedom, and the gratitude that Europeans had for America when that happened. And I think now we're headed in the wrong direction as it relates to Russian aggression.
More generally, then, what's happening on the ground in the United States with deportations and ICE, and I think, again, a lot of people here are watching what's happening, really aghast, you know, with these masked men going around in vans, picking people off the streets and people, you know, disappearing for days on end with families not knowing where they are. And we have our own story of Donna Hughes Brown, and originally from Ireland, but has been living in the United States for most of her life. She's a 58-year-old grandmother, and she was detained by ICE over a $25 check misdemeanor 10 years ago. She was put in medical solitary confinement for a period of time. And we've been speaking on this station to her husband, Jim Brown. It's just one instance of some of the stories that are happening, you know, which I think...
I think there's been a disproportionate response from ICE to many of these cases, coupled with the following fact. There are 4 million Americans who are living in what is known as mixed status. They might have come here as being undocumented, but their children were born here. So generally in legislative nuance, those are the sorts of problems that you would try to fix. And at the same time, there is no defense here, particularly on the Democratic side, to felonious behavior. If you have a hardcore criminal in the United States, we want them out. But we also want to make sure that those who even are trying to regularize their status at a federal courthouse are not being picked up and deported without any sort of due process. So I think that the president's reaction to this has been, again, over the top. Nobody is defending felonies. Nobody is defending raw criminal behavior. But there are people in the United States that have been here for decades. They've obeyed the law. They've raised their families. And here's an interesting economic concept. They pay $22 billion a year into the Social Security system, trust fund, where they will never enjoy that benefit because they've used false identification. So remember, there have been plenty of plans, and President Trump is the one that got in the way of the last plan just before he became president again, when we had actually reached an agreement, and he said that Republicans should reject the agreement because it would be harmful to his political prospects.
Can I ask you finally then, Congressman, if we look at what's happened with the crackdown on free speech in the last, even just the last couple of weeks, the deportation that I mentioned, the tariffs, the approach to NATO, the approach to Gaza, the approach to wars generally, the Department of War instead of the Department of Defense, do you recognize America today?
Of course, I recognize America because I think that it's the principle of the United States. And even when you look at polling on this, the president speaks for a minority on this very issue. And his threats to free speech, what he essentially is saying is that if it's speech that does not agree with him, that it can't be entertained. As we're speaking, I just left the class that I've taught for many years at the University of Massachusetts. And I must tell you that free speech in the American universities is a staple of American life. Our Bill of Rights.
Well, it was.
We're celebrating a Declaration of Independence.
You know, it was, but people being picked up for writing op-eds about Gaza, you know, being deported.
Well, it's beyond me, and I think many of us have spoken out against this. I think that the First Amendment to our Constitution is precious. It's the cornerstone of American life, and we need to not only observe it and honor it, but cherish it.
Well, it's very interesting to speak to you, and thank you for taking the time to join us on the program this evening, Richard Neal. I do appreciate your time.